Welcome to the Perp Web Podcast, hosted by Joe Bosch.
I'm going to answer a couple of questions before I start my presentation. And both questions, it appears, are they're from two different people, but they're basically the same question. And it has to do with post-cardiotomy patients weaning off bypass and having big problems with bleeding. You know, what can we do about this problem? And look, I mean, that's in this one here, VA ECMO support post-cardiotomy patient, but we can't handle the bleeding problem. Can you advise on tip for this situation? Well, you know, this is a big problem, and I do want John, is he back yet? I do want him to participate in this, but I'll give you basically my very quick overview on this. And I've seen it a lot. If you can make sure that your central cannulas are well secured and you can treat the platelet your platelet count by giving platelet transfusions, giving cryoprecipitate, giving fresh frozen plasma, making sure that your hemoglobin or your hematocrit is at a good level. In these patients, I would much prefer 30 over anything less than that. I think it makes all the difference in the world. And if you just have general coagulopathy, that's just going to take some time. Now, a patient like that, we're certainly not going to give protamine, right? You can't give protamine weaning off pump and transitioning to ECMO. You have to suffer through what you're experiencing until the heparin level comes down enough to where you can get control of some of this. Making sure that you can approximate the skin or just use a Viadrape if that's what you want to use. That happens a lot. But you want to have something in there that you can suck that blood instead of into the atrium chest tube chambers. You want to make sure that you have it going to a cell saver so that you can reclaim that blood. Now, you can't the products. You're still going to have to be administering those as time goes on. But I have seen a lot of bleeding resolve that has been general coagulopathy when you treat it well. I would certainly use TEG. TEG is a very valuable tool in this circumstance to make sure you're transfusing the right thing. But you want to keep your hematocrit up. You want to keep the viscosity of the blood good. You want the viscosity up. You want to check your TEG. You want to make sure that you're keeping your COP or your collaronic pressure and osmolality normalized to reduce the third spacing that occurs, because they will bleed more when they do that. And you check the TEG and make sure that you're transfusing what is needed to get a more normal coagulation profile on your numbers. And then it's time. So the patient will probably need a washout, but when you have excessive bleeding, just massive amounts of bleeding, and I've seen that too, it is almost always the arterial cannula, the aortic cannula is bleeding, or there is something else that is pumping. But everybody gets tired. They're done with this case. They can't do anymore. You take them, pack them up and take them to the ICU. Hope that when they put the darkness on it, that the bleeding is going to stop. And frequently it does not. And then you just have to get everybody sort of recentered. You're going to be busy transfusing. And then you have to take them back to the operating room for a washout and exploration and start making whatever little corrections you can make. It's really it's a time game for me. But that's what we see. And that's my answer to your question. I hope I was able to answer it well, but that's the best answer I can give you. John, are you there? So, John, I just got through discussing, and I'd like you to just tackle it as well independently. A question from a few different people that on their patients that they failed to wean off bypass going to VA ECMO, that they have had a lot of problems with bleeding and almost to the point of being nearly unmanageable. And is there anything we could do to help them with that? I sort of answered that question, but if you want to, why don't you answer that question as well and let them hear the two different perspectives?
Well, I'm coming in a little bit, I guess, after your answer. But okay, so if you have a patient on bypass in the OR doing poorly, they decide to go on VA ECMO, what do you do with your heparinization right at that point now that you're on ECMO? You've still got an ACT of greater than 480. What is your plan? What are you going to do next with that?
What am I going to do?
Or what is the caller going to do? Are they going to leave it?
Yes. I mean, I think by and large, I think nobody's going to, I mean, I'm not going to give, I wouldn't recommend giving protamine. I told them it's a waiting game. Heparin has a 90-minute half-life, you know, after about 450 minutes or so, 560 minutes, you've lost, the heparin is gone. But of course, you can always give, you know, the prothrombinex. You can give you could give factor 7 if you thought that was the issue. But from my perspective, John, my whole point was that I think most times when the bleeding is that excessive, it's a cannula that's leaking. But everybody's exhausted. The case has taken forever. And they just want to get them to the unit now. And most of the time you end up taking them back to do a washout and you find these little things. And you just have to take the time to do it. But sometimes after the case has beaten you up, you just can't see it anymore. You can't find it. You can't deal with it. You just want to go. And that does happen. So my solution was give it time, let the heparin start to wear off. You're going to be busy. Give products, use TEG, use a cell saver if you put a Vidrape or even if you close the chest to reclaim the bleeding that is occurring. So at least you give the red cells back and then give appropriate products to try and get their numbers at least normal. And then it's really just a waiting game and make sure you have great cannula site integrity so that the cannulas are not bleeding, because that's a big problem.
Well, are they staying on central cannulation? If they're staying on central cannulation, they shouldn't have cannula site bleeding, hopefully, but they need to find out what the source of the bleeding is. So now, if you have a fully heparinized patient and you're not going to reverse any of the protamine, which I know is an extremely scary thought, however, we do have an enormous amount of experience with reversing 50% of the heparin with protamine while on ECMO, and I've seen that done. I'm sure that's probably not in anybody's recommended guidelines, probably not in anybody's recommended protocol, but there is a technique where you reverse very slowly 50% of the heparin with protamine. But besides that, time will let it wear off. You need to do the TEGs, as you said, and give the products that are going to try to bring your TEG as close to normal as possible. But with that much heparin on board, you know, what the TEG is going to show, your R is going to be very, very prolonged for starters.
Yes, agreed. But at least it helps you, I think, as it continues to improve. You're going to empirically give products. I said you really want to make sure. I like a hematocrit in those patients above 30. I don't like them to have Kool-Aid circulating around them. I think you really have to address and manage all of the third spacing. I think that makes coagulopathy worse. So I think high hematocrit or higher hematocrit, good COP and osmolality control, and then also making sure that you address any surgical bleeding and that you have good integrity of your central cannulas, because I've had it happen to me several times where the arterial cannula was bleeding horribly. And we brought the patient back and started correcting these things, and things just got better. It's a waiting game, basically. It's just time. You're just busy for a period of time until you can get all of the coagulation factor derangements under control, is what I think.
I think you should try to get as good as possible in the OR. Go ahead and stay in the OR a couple, three more hours and get things, at least quite a bit better, because if you just send over to the ICU and hope for the best, you know you're coming back. You know the chest tube's going to drain 1,000 an hour, and you're going to be coming back in a few hours anyway, maybe sooner. And by then, if you'd stayed in the OR, you probably could have continued to address some of the surgical bleeding, continue to give the products, and watch things begin to improve in the OR. It's painful. It's already been a long case. You're on ECMO. You weren't expecting to be on ECMO. You know, you bought the farm, and at this point, you just got to stay with it until and tough it out. Because to send to the ICU, mm-hmm. when things are a mess, they're not going to get much better in the ICU very easily.
I agree. I've done it a lot of times, though. I've seen it happen a lot of times, John. That's not an uncommon phenomenon to occur. And it sounds like it occurs in other parts of the world, too. But, you know, be that as it may, I think your advice is very good. If you can stay in the operating room, just pack it and then tell the surgeon, go take a break. You know, we've got this until, you know, and let them de-stress themselves and come back, as opposed to all of the hoopla that's associated with moving this highly unstable patient and then having to move them back. Just stay in the operating room and deal with it, because you will make the rest of the time for that patient and everybody else that's taking care of the patient much more sane at the end of the day. I don't like giving depending on the cause of the coagulopathy. I mean, if the coagulopathy is being caused by platelet or from factor deficiency, then I don't like giving these like factor 7 and the prothrombin X and all that stuff, or the other stuff, the K, what is that other, K-Centra. Yeah, that's the name of it. I don't like giving that stuff, because you got to address the issue of the product deficiency is what you need to be addressing, not giving that, unless the cause is true coagulopathy. Now, if I think it's hyperfibrinolysis, Amicar or Trans-X is certainly a good option as well. I don't know what you do with that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But some of your K-Centra and your different things have those heavy factor 7, I think it is, in there and things like that. And a lot of times, if you boost up the patient's factor 7 and a couple other factors that are in those ingredients and those drugs, you'll see some improvement. But I would caution against one thing. K-Centra on ECMO is very, very risky. You have about a 10 to 15% chance of sudden clot off of the ECMO. And you don't know if it's going to happen. You just have to sit there and have a circuit ready. Because whenever we give it, we're on the edge of our seats for the first 30 minutes to an hour. And if it doesn't happen, it's not going to happen. But when you give that K-Centra sometimes, wow, it just clots off the whole circuit instantly sometimes. You just never know.
Agreed.
So it's really risky on ECMO.
Very good. Okay, so let's go on to my slides. I'm going to try to blaze through this next set of slides, hemodynamic monitoring and ECMO. This is an article out of, I believe it was, let me see, it was out of Cologne, Germany. And I don't remember the journal it was in, though. I think it was Thoracic Surgery. I'm pretty sure. I think it was Thoracic Surgery. However, let's just very briefly go over what we already have talked about a billion times. Indications and contraindications for use of ECLS. Let's just do the contraindications, because everybody knows what the indications are. But if you have multi-morbidity organ dysfunction, advanced multi-organ failure, inclusive of sepsis, signs of an active bleeding, which is intracranial or lung, you have a pulmonary hemorrhage, please don't do ECMO. Signs of severe neurologic disorder, advanced age and frailty, and that's somewhat relative, so, you know, take that into consideration. You should restrict access to VA ECMO or ECLS if you are morbidly obese and more than 3 to 4 times your ideal body weight, or you have severe PVD, or you have contraindications for anticoagulation. Now, I will say that's relative, because, John, you're saying you can do this without anticoagulation, you know, and in this case, they're saying that it is, you should restrict the access. But it doesn't say that it is a hard and fast thing. So, you know, maybe things like that are changing. And then concerns that we have about ECMO. ECMO usage has increased substantially. There's no doubt about that. And I think you're going to see it continue to increase, especially since we've had this latest episode. Each one of these episodes, even if it ends up that ECMO may not have been that beneficial to a large enough number of people that had developed COVID-19-associated pulmonary failure, what we have learned through this period of time is going to transcend those patients and is going to have an effect on how we manage other patients for other problems in which ECMO has already a very robust survival rate, and you're going to see that improve even more. So I believe that ECMO usage is going to continue to climb, certainly nationally, and I do believe also internationally. There is a very strong association, however, and this cannot be understated, between hospital experience and outcomes. If you do one ECMO a year, you cannot possibly expect to have the same outcomes as somebody who does 100 ECMOs per year. There's just no way, or even more than that in some cases, but there's no way. So you really have to consider your capabilities. If you do very few but need the capability because you can't transport or get somebody there fast enough to initiate it, and you want to initiate ECMO, but you have a plan to transfer once stable on ECMO, I'm supportive of that. But that has to be put into the planning ahead of time before you initiate an ECMO program. John, I hope that's one of your other biggest mistakes people make on your program.
What I was going to say was what I've seen, it's not so much, it's a mistake as far as not being prepared for the ECMO that you're, for the program, is completely got its full talent of people in place 24/7. But what I've seen in my travels here in the last 6-7 weeks with COVID is a sudden surprise, you are now an ECMO program, has happened, because what's happened in some very, very large centers that were basically the hub and spoke model, where the hub received all these outside referrals, people would, you know, insert and ship all in the same day. Within a few hours, they put the ECMO on and they were out the door. They had no intention of keeping the ECMO. It's not anything they've ever done. They have an agreement with a very large university center or something like that to accept their ECMOs. Well, all of a sudden here comes COVID, and that large hub has said, hey, wait a second, you're keeping your ECMOs. We're not taking anymore. We've got way too much going on. Our bed space is limited. Our ECMO capabilities are maxed out. You're going to have to start keeping your ECMOs. And I've been recently to a half a dozen places where they've said, this is our first or second ECMO. We normally don't ever do ECMO here. So you had no CCM, critical care medicine, no nurses, no ECMO. Even one place had no perfusionists. Didn't even have them on staff. They didn't have, it wasn't even a heart center. They basically would ship an ECMO the second they got it, and now all of a sudden found themselves suddenly as an ECMO program. So that was an interesting side effect of all this COVID overwhelming of bed space with COVID that I've seen.
Yeah, and I think that was predictable and probably should have been addressed ahead of time, but I'm sure we'll get to that. That's another good talk, actually. But what you just got through saying, and my next concern is, what I'm about to tell you highlights the need for familiarity with the nuances of ECMO, because ECMO is an art form. There are guidelines, there are protocols, there's a lot of data, but there's also a lot of opinion and experience and the conflicting data. So I think you really have to be, you have to know what you're doing. But more importantly, ECMO changes the hemodynamic monitoring model of the patient, depending on what's VA or VV. A lot of things happen that make our traditional approach towards assessing a patient's perfusion, their cardiac function, their volume status, a whole bunch of things change, and you have to understand it or you will misinterpret what you're seeing. And it's very important that we discuss these things. So some of my key points are that ECMO perturbs the circulation such that many monitoring methods become invalid. Point of care ultrasound is uniquely valuable, and I can't stress this enough, for monitoring both VV and VA ECMO patients. As ECMO patients are subject to multiple threats to perfusion, perfusion deficits, intensivists, perfusionists should master tools for judging its adequacy. Adequacy of perfusion is extremely important to understand when you're doing ECMO, and you really do need to understand it. You can't be trying to figure it out as you go. You need to understand it. And syndromes especially important to monitor in ECMO patients include LV distension, new onset RV failure, cannula malposition, and extremity ischemia. These are common, very usual problems that occur that you need to be able to identify, recognize, and treat early to avoid there being basically a situation where it is now not recoverable. Uh-oh, what happened? Oh, there. So let's split this up into VA and VV. So we'll do VV first. Sufficient O2 transport to the tissues depends on two determinant factors, O2 content and global perfusion. Threats to perfusion are always present during ECMO. You have RV dysfunction issues, you have hemorrhage, which we've sort of belabored here a little bit, you have hypovolemia, you have vasoplegia, but you can also have, you know, massive third spacing. That's not on there, should be on there. And VV, there is no direct circulatory support. You have to make sure you understand that. However, there's a caveat, and I talked about it in the very first slide. If you have a ischemic heart secondary to hypoxemia, then yes, it will have a circulatory, an indirect effect on circulatory support by making the heart work better. But there's no direct circulatory support with VV ECMO. Very important point that we have to remember. Judging perfusion adequacy, there's fundamental goal during critical illness, or it is rather a fundamental goal. Conventional vital signs such as blood pressure, heart rate, urine output, all have very substantial limitations in judging perfusion adequacy, especially when on ECMO. So I want to go over this slide, and this is a very good slide. I covered up the VA section because we're going to look at it in VA as well. So when you look at the venous oxygen, oxyhemoglobin saturation, it's potentially valid. And it depends on the site of the venous cannula and how much recirculation is present. Note that arteriovenous saturation difference for those with arterial hypoxemia. Pulse oximetry is usually valid in VV. During VA ECMO, however, it's different. So I'm just going to leave anything that's valid or usually valid, I'm going to leave it go. Indicator dilution, which is basically a thermal dilution swan or something like that, lacks validity, may be valid during VV at low blood flow rates. So the issue here is you may be losing some of the flow that you're expecting when you do the thermal dilution. You're going to lose the dilutant itself. So it's going to get captured by the ECMO. So you have to turn the flow way, 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 way down. NIRS is valid. LVO2 VTI is valid. Pulse contour stroke volume is valid. Again, this is because you basically have normal cardiac function. You have a closed loop taking blood from the venous system, putting it back into the right atrium, and it's a closed loop. Point of care ultrasound is valid, and pulse pressure variation, stroke volume variation to predict fluid response, it lacks validity. The value compromised by small tidal volume, reduced lung compliance, and ventricular dysfunction. So the thing about pulse pressure variation and stroke volume variation is you need to be mechanically ventilated with at least 70 cc's per kilogram in order to be able to have a valid PPV or SVV. So you have to remember that. So when you turn because you have stiff lungs now, you turn that volume all the way down and you're doing your ARDS-NET protocol ventilation with low volumes and all the various other mechanisms that are done. I'm not a ventilation expert or ventilator expert. John might be able to expand on a little bit. It makes PPV and SVV no longer applicable because you need that increase and decrease in intrathoracic pressure to be able to get that to occur. That's why that only really occurs with mechanical ventilation.
But we largely have the vent turned way down, do we not? Is that a big factor here as to why that wouldn't be very accurate?
Yes, because usually you're going to be way down to about 30. You're going to try to get down to 30 cc's or 40 cc's per kilo. So on your vent volume, because when you don't want your peak pressure too high, right? So if your peak pressure is very high, you're going to decrease those volumes, have higher PEEP, and you're going to just sort of be, faster rate, low volumes, try to get the FiO2, the inspired FiO2 down. And so you need a normal mechanical ventilation with a ventilator at a volume of at least 70 cc's per kilo in order for the hypovolemia to be reflected in your pulse pressure or stroke volume variation.
Dick Joe, the disc slide's worth leaving up for just a second. I think we should discuss a teeny bit about the venous, the first one there, venous oxyhemoglobin saturation.
Yes.
On VV ECMO, what does that mean? What is your number that you're seeing mean? Where are you monitoring it? And what can you derive from that? And where would be the accurate place to monitor your venous oxyhemoglobin saturation? Do you have thoughts about that? I
do have thoughts about that. And I think the only thing you really could do maybe is jugular bulb. But I think anything lower than that, you're really going to be seeing an influence of your return and probably having it affected by your oxygenated blood returning. So I think it will be artificially elevated. And without knowing what it is without ECMO flow, you don't know how much it's being affected. And I think that's why at the end of my slides today, I talk a little bit about the transonic device, which is used for measuring recirculation in an accurate way, which is going to give you, I think, a little more confidence. But I would probably say jugular bulb if you were going to really try to get an SVO2. That's what I would do.
Is there any way to measure an SVO2 on the tip of the PA catheter sitting in the pulmonary artery?
I mean, I'm sure you could probably draw something from it, but that's going to be contaminated with the blood you're pumping back to the right atrium. I mean, if you want a true SVO2.
The problem with the SVO2 on the ECMO is that it's always got a factor of a mixing component there that we don't know what that is.
Yeah,
the problem with monitoring it in the SVC or right atrium is basically a similar problem.
Yeah.
Is you don't know how much is being sensed by, modified by the ECMO itself. But what makes it to the pulmonary artery seems to me that now you would get, you're not getting a patient SVO2, that's the problem.
Yes,
you're
that's correct.
Oxygenated. Yeah,
that's
so that
why I
work.
Said the jugular bulb, because you're higher than your access point of if you're using a single double cannula technique, or even if you're using, or a single cannula rather, but even if you're using double cannula, your return is going to be below it. So it would give you at least probably the best opportunity to get that. But I think there's other surrogates that you could use. So, you know, that's you know, my view on that. I don't think that's why it says potentially
from, like, the left arm or something.
I mean, no, but I don't think that's really going to be a an SVO2. That might be maybe a venous saturation from the arm, but I don't I think you need to be, you know, your head is obviously going to use more oxygen than anything else. Your SVO2 there is going to be lower. So that's the one you really, I think, want to measure. That's what I think.
Okay.
So I have in VA ECMO, on the other hand, I have three key concerns. We talked about this already, differential hypoxemia. I worry about that tremendously. LV distension and dilation, I worry about that tremendously. And limb ischemia is a very real problem that has to be addressed, or you're going to start seeing elevated lactates, they're going to get gangrene, and they're going to need an amputation, and it's very ugly. We talked about differential hypoxemia already. It's related to inadequate lung oxygenation and continued LV ejections. The use of NIRS can be very helpful for a continuous monitor to look at cerebral oxygen saturations. And if you are going to measure blood gas, you don't have NIRS and you're going to be measuring blood gases, it is absolutely essential that you measure those blood gases from the right radial artery or right brachial, just out in the right arm somewhere, please. Arterial pressure waveform, well, you're going to have a decrease in with VA ECMO in the pulse pressure, and it would likely indicate a decrease in LV stroke volume, but not necessarily. And it is variable based on prior cardiac function, current afterload, LV volume status, and adequate pulse pressure is alone not reassuring in an isolated sense for not having LV distension. So you can have little pulses and go, oh, I feel good about that. You know, we've got some pulses, the heart's emptying. No, the heart could be blowing up and just doing this and get just enough pressure generated to open the aortic valve, depending on how much afterload it has to beat against. So if you're running a sort of a low pressure, then like down around the 50 range, you might actually get an ejection, a little bit of one, and say, I feel comfortable. Doesn't mean anything. That's why I think you got to go back to the bedside transthoracic echo. I think it's very important. And that's what comes up is they call it POCUS. I think you're going to hear a lot more about this, point of care ultrasound. Evaluation of ventricular size and function guides your pharmacologic therapies because you can see, you don't have to wait for them to bring the machine. You don't have to wait for them to get the tech to come do the echo, and it becomes a big event. It should just be there. If you have an ECMO program, you're doing VA ECMO, even VV, but especially VA, you should have an echo available to you whenever you want it to evaluate the ventricular function, because every change you make has a potential effect, and you want to see what that effect was without having to wait until tomorrow. Guide use effectiveness of decompressing technology. So this is what POCUS will do. It helps you decide, do I need an Impella? Should I put a transseptal or a direct LV vent in through the apex? Or if you have done if it's a post-cardiotomy and the chest is open already, go ahead and put it in through the right superior pulmonary vein and then through the mitral down into the LV. Extremity perfusion, you need to monitor this regularly. You can use, of course, the NIRS for that too. You can put the NIRS on the extremities and it does work, gives you some sense that you are perfusing the legs. Of course, you can look at them and you can feel them. If they're relatively warm and they don't look mottled, then they're not getting purple or turning into Smurf toes, you know, you're likely doing a good job and you're probably okay. You can try using Doppler, of course, temperature of the foot and appearance. If you're having an issue, you put an SFA distal perfusion cannula in and you just use a lure lock and put it on the stopcock where the cannula, the opti has, and the 3H tubing is connected, and just put it right in there. We use a little cardioplegia Y line to do ours, and it just works really beautifully. It's very simple to do. So now let's look at VA on that same chart. In VA, now your SpO2 is valid, completely valid. In your VA pulse oximetry, it lacks validity, typically because you don't have enough of a pulse pressure. It just isn't going to sense. And I've seen that happen before where there's no pulse ox, there's no pulse ox. Yeah, but there's no pulse. Well, but they can't be alive. No, they're alive. They have continuous flow. And, you know, just as a caveat to that, the images that we have and videos that we have of reviewing or viewing the microcirculation, it is typically continuous. It's not pulsatile, which is very interesting. The flow through the capillary is one red blood cell at a time, and it's a continuous flow, not a pulsatile flow. So I still haven't figured out why we have a pulse, unless it's just how the heart got designed, because every long-term VAD, every total artificial heart created today is all done off of continuous flow technology because they don't break like a pulsatile flow does. But I do think it requires some adaptability because when I measure the microcirculation, when I'm doing hearts and they go on pump, with continuous flow short term, I see a tremendous decrease in capillary density and capillary flow. It's amazing at what happens. And then when you see the native circulation restored, you see that return. So short term, I think there really is a big difference in how our physiology works with pulsatile flow and capillary perfusion, microcirculatory perfusion, but I think that our bodies are able to, over time, adapt to it. But I think that is one of the big reasons that duration of bypass, how long you were on pump, is an independent indicator or predictor of mortality. And I think that's the reason for it. We don't have enough time to adapt to this new situation, and we have so many other things happening at the same time as opposed to just one.
Hey Joe, I think that topic right there of pulse versus non-pulse and our physiology could be a very nice 1 or 2 hour webinar for the future. There's research that's been done here at this hospital with regard to that, and long-term patients, bad patients do adapt, and in fact, on the capillary level, it seems to be that it's a constant flow, which we both know. However, the research shows that whether it's when you have a pulse, it's the energy that's delivered to the physiology that has some type of positive impact on our systems. A pulse, you think to yourself, well, you know, what's the difference if it's pulsatile or constant? Constant actually seems like even makes a little bit more sense. But when we look at our physiology and we're used to a pulse, there's a tremendous amount of energy that is delivered along with that pulsatile flow. And it's probably way beyond our knowledge and understanding at the moment as to what all that energy is doing and what effect it's having. But there's something there to the energy that's delivered to our system via that pulsatile flow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. You know what? That would be a really good topic. But nevertheless, let's go ahead and move on because I know I'm going to run out of time here. Indicator dilution lacks validity, and it's common sense, right? You shoot your RV is being drained, and you're decompressing it, and then pumping it into the femoral system. It says lacks validity, but I can't even believe it would have any validity. NEARS has validity for obvious reasons. Left ventricular outflow tract velocity time is obviously lacks validity, but it may be able to demonstrate the presence of LV ejection even without a measurable pulse on your radial line or distal arterial line catheter. Pulse contour stroke volume obviously lacks validity. POCUS is very valid. Again, I said that several times. I think that needs to become much more common. I would love to have the ability to just do a TTE anytime I wanted to at the bedside with some of these ECMO patients when we're trying to wean, changing flows, making decisions about, is this a volume issue? Is this a cannulation issue? Is this a decompensation of whatever function we previously had issue? What is going on here? It would be so helpful to have. And then obviously PPV and SVV for fluid response, it lacks validity. That would be for obvious reasons, I think. Weaning ultrasound, very, very important to assess LV function and makes the weaning process so much more effective. But it does require a cessation of support in order for it to be completely valid. Is this patient going to be able to make it off of ECMO? There's other ways to do it too, and using microcirculatory measurements, viewer, dark, it's called dark field side stream imaging, is extremely helpful for this as well. But I think ECHO is maybe a little bit easier to do. I'm not sure, because that other thing is pretty easy too. But you need to stop the pump at some point. And you really need to consider your anticoagulation status at that point, because ceasing flow, if you are inadequately anticoagulated, is obviously going to have a catastrophic event should you have to go back on flow. So it has to be brief, but you need to make sure that it can be longer the more anticoagulated you are. I would also put a recirc in. This is the transonic device I talked about, and this device does three things. It measures flow on a continuous basis. It measures the amount of recirculation in your VV ECMO patients and our cannulation strategy, and it simultaneously measures the intraoxygenator blood volume. So if you know your oxygenator has a blood volume of 220 cc's, that's what the manufacturer, the MFU, says, and you know that to be true, and you start your ECMO immediately and run a baseline and it comes back 220 cc's, and then you're out in the Wild West on the East Coast where John is in Florida, and you're doing these ECMOs without any anticoagulation, and you wait 4, 5, 6 days, or do it the next day, or do it every day. I would say do it at least once a day would be appropriate if you have the device. And you measure your intraoxygenator blood volume, and it goes from 220 to 200 to 180 to 150. Well, in 4 day period of time, well, that volume is not being occupied by popcorn. It's being occupied, the only thing it could be is clot. And so you can know when your oxygenator is starting to clot. And it's very interesting, several papers out there that you can lose almost 70% of your oxygenator volume before you see an appreciable change in your delta P. And most people, at least I have, I've abandoned, and I think most people I know have abandoned, measuring pre and post membrane pressures. We don't measure them anymore. Do you do that? Do you measure them, John? I don't measure them.
Yeah, because you get them automatically on the CardioHelp.
Automatically. You use CardioHelp. We don't use the CardioHelp.
Are you using this device to tell you the status of your oxygenator? How are you keeping track of that?
Yes. So this device is just fantastic. It's very portable. One can cover, any number of patients, any number of hospitals. You just take it, you hook it up, you put the patient information in, it stores it, so you don't have to always do that. Do an injection of 20 cc's of saline. It sort of has instructions how to do it. It has two probes, one on the access, one on the return. And with that one injection, now it's going to give you flow immediately, so it's an ultrasonic flow meter. But as soon as you give that injection, takes about 60 seconds, and it does its calculations, and it will give you your percentage of recirculation if you're VV, not if you're VA, obviously. If you're VV, it gives you percent of recirculation, and it gives you your intraoxygenator blood volume in about 60 seconds. So you know what your effective ECMO flow is, because it gives you that number as well. So if you're flowing 5 liters and you have 20% recirculation, the math is simple. It's going to be 4 liters of effective ECMO flow. And but it's an excellent tool, because I've seen recirculation of 15%. I've seen recirculation of 50%. And that one that was 50% with cannula manipulation, we were able to significantly improve the patient's oxygenation arterially and made for a much better opportunity for survival for that particular patient, because we were really struggling and we couldn't understand what the issue was. But it was cannulation placement.
Joe, how often are you seeing with that device, probably almost on a daily basis, you're able to see your oxygenator volumes dropping, which means it's being replaced with clot inside the oxygenator. That's what it's telling you. And then about the recirculation aspect of it, what has been your experience with how different from patient to patient, and how many instances have you seen where maybe you've done something to improve your recirculation?
Yeah, so I would say that the most of the time, anything that is 20% or less of recirculation, we accept. You know, the enemy of good is better, right? Anything higher, like in the 25, 30%, we will try to make a few minor little adjustments, but it's what's so important about this is you want to do this while the cannula is being placed. Everybody's there. Nothing has been sutured down. So you make your adjustment at the time of insertion. What I have experienced is that once you have gotten an optimal position and they secure it well, nothing changes. We've flipped patients over with no prone bed, literally taken the patient and turned them prone and turn them back over the course of several days with no prone bed, nothing automated at all about it, and the recirculation continues to stay where it is within an acceptable range. It might be 15, 17, 20, 18, something like that, but it doesn't go 15 to 30. So we haven't experienced that at all. As far as the oxygenator volume is concerned, I have seen that we're very careful about our anticoagulation protocol. We don't do no heparin, but we have had a very good experience. In fact, we haven't had any case where the oxygenator blood volume was reduced by more than maybe 15% at best over the course of 10 days, 10 to 14 days. What happens is the fibers just wet out before we have that occur. But our oxygenated blood volume has stayed very stable. And I think I would really like for you to do it with your patients that you are not anticoagulating, because I think it would be, if you had virtually no other change, I think that would be so incredibly powerful and valid that it would help so many of everybody. It would help me. If I had that data, I would be like, okay, I mean, this is conclusive in my view.
Yeah, that would be interesting. What about in terms of, have you experimented with the device and taking a patient and increasing and decreasing the flow to see where your optimal flow is and your minimal mixing is? Have you experimented with that?
Yes, absolutely. And I have been able to demonstrate that coming down on the flow has decreased recirculation and increased effective ECMO flow simply by reducing the RPMs. And I had mentioned that in the very beginning, but I knew I had this information moving forward. But thank you for that question, because I really did want to make that point, and it's a very good point. Okay, so last thing, John, is microcirculation. You and I have discussed this before. This is what the device looks like. I happen to have one. It is from MicroScan microvision scan in Amsterdam. You can find them online. It is a very interesting, unique device. And let me show you what you see. And this is a good example. If you look at A, which is relatively normal, same patient B, you have a very deranged microcirculation. I don't have it on video, but you can find these videos if you just go on YouTube and type in dark field side stream imaging, or DFSFI, you will find these videos of microcirculation that these devices, and this particular one is a very easy to use, very nice device. And it is measuring, what you're seeing there is down in the, you know, 7 to 10 micron range, and seeing actual capillary density and watching them disappear during various moments, or watching hyperemic flow through, like in sepsis, through the capillaries, seeing capillary bridging. You can see all of these things. The bigger vessels that you see are arterioles and venules, but the capillaries are very, very small. And this sees a lot, and it's a very unique tool. I really enjoy it. And here you can see what happens from 0 minutes to 10 minutes before hypoxia, during hypoxia, and after hypoxia. So if you look at the left, you see the larger arterioles and venules, but you also see the very small little capillaries, okay? The things that I was saying down around 7-10 microns. And then at 3 minutes, you can still see them, okay? That's before hypoxemia. During hypoxemia, look, and you can see them disappearing. And then after hypoxemia, all the way out to 10 minutes, look at the difference in those really small vessels, the ones where gas exchange is actually going to occur. And it's amazing to see this happen. I have watched this happen by myself. And I would love to bring this out to your place too and show this to you, because I think it is just such an incredibly unique tool that is so underappreciated and has such incredibly valuable information. For ECMO, in fact, there's great papers out there talking about the use of this for weaning off of bypass. So using this as a metric to determine whether or not the patient is going to successfully wean. You go from 100% to 50% VA ECMO flow, and if your microcirculation stays intact, this particular article, and I can't remember the name of it right now, I'll have to get that reference if anybody wants it, or you can try to find it yourself online, I'm sure it's there. You have a statistically significant improved chance of that patient being successfully weaned from VA ECMO. Now, it's not the only thing you look at, but I think it should be one of the things, because if you see the microcirculation just drop off and go down, going from 100 to 50%, they say in the paper that patient is likely not coming off ECMO at that point. But if you have it maintained, then that patient is likely going to come off ECMO if you continue with the weaning process. And I think it's a very powerful article, and I recommend people find it. I'm gonna try to reference it in the YouTube. So I have a little bit of discussion time, John. I know we're running over. We belabored a lot of points. Any final thoughts maybe you could give us about all of this and what your thoughts are about these technologies? Because hemodynamic monitoring is not just blood pressure. It's not just urine output. It's not just, laboratories and, you know, the routine labs that we do and all of that. It's more than that, right? And I think we need to take all of these things into consideration. We need to know whether we're developing clot in our oxygen. We need to know what our recirculation is on VV ECMO. We need to know what our microcirculation is doing, because you can have all the circulatory flow you want. If you don't have microcirculatory flow, the outcome is predictable.
you know, I think a lot of our measurements are sort of gross macrovascular measurements. You know what I mean? We don't have a whole lot of microvascular measurements. In fact, I don't know if we have really any. One thing I like, we didn't talk a lot about the NIRS in this particular lecture, but we've talked about them before, especially if you put them on different limbs, compare different limbs and the head, you'll see regional differences. I mean, that may be about the closest thing we have, which is not very good, to kind of measuring near our capillary perfusion. And even that, as we know, because of the depth of how that measures, is actually a very poor indicator more than anything. But, you know, what the next frontier for what we do should be microcirculation.
I think so, too.
This is an area that we just never delve very much into, not much as perfusionists anyway. And it ought to really be, you know, this is where the rubber meets the road. At the capillary level is where gas exchange occurs. We talk about
gas exchange, nutrient exchange, everything exchanges.
Right, and you know, we're looking at SpO2s. Well, that's not very accurate. Our cardiac outputs on BV ECMO, no matter what you use, not very accurate. You're trying to draw from the right radial, and you're hoping that that's giving you, you know, what you need to know that's going to the brain. So, you know, but if we knew exactly on the capillary level in the brain and in the tissues what is really happening, I think there's a whole frontier of knowledge that we could expand ourselves and really learn. You know, and you know, we have another inference is lactates. We infer a lot from lactates, and we've discovered that there's times when lactates are low, but tissue perfusion is poor, and we've actually seen the opposite as well. It's not 100% of an indicator, although they tend to think it is.
And they lag. They lag.
It's a big lag. That's one.
And they
problem.
Can happen for a variety of reasons. You know, at all kinds of, and it can be masked. You have the patient on CRRT, you may not see and I didn't even discuss that, but if you have a patient on CRRT and you're doing high replacement volume, high effluent volume, then you will mask that lactate level because it's going to clear it very effectively, very quickly.
Yeah, and the other thing too is, you know, with all the huge concerns and all the things we talk about with acute kidney injury, wouldn't it be good to know if we could monitor on the nephron and the capillary level of the kidney, the perfusion that we're actually doing with non-pulsatile flow on perfusion, with ECMO and other things, maybe there's a whole ton to be learned there about what's really going on with AKI, as opposed to all the theories and inferences about all the many, many things that are accused of contributing to AKI. You know, I think there's a lot to be learned there on the microcirculation, just in all kinds of areas.
I think so, too. I think you're 100% right. You hit the nail on the head. So, okay, so in deference to, John, your time and to everyone else out there that has stayed with us, I think we were supposed to end at 10:20. So I think we're actually really, no, 10:15. So we just went a little bit over, but it makes up for yesterday when we were a little bit under. So hopefully the board will be happy with that. Every once in a while, I kind of sort of make one go over a little bit. Monday, August 10th, 9 a.m., same place. We're going to have Tammy Sparacino's Journal Club. We're going to be tackling the topic of predictors of heparin resistance before cardiovascular operations in adults. And there's going to be the second installment of our M&M, our Morbidity Mortality Conference, Learning from Others' Mistakes. And the case that I'm going to discuss is going to be very interesting indeed. And, you know, I'm hopeful that by the time I finish this M&M series, that everybody out there gets themselves a really good prescription for Zoloft, because there's a lot of bad things that happen in heart surgery that perfusion is related to, and we never, ever hear about it. And I think it's so important that we reveal this stuff because... you know, the old saying, John, there's those that have and there's those that will.
Correct. By Charlie Reed.
That's right. That's exactly right. Exactly right. Okay. Good day, everyone. Thank you, John, once again. I love you. I appreciate you so very much. Did you see that comment that we got from Down Under?
No, I'm not watching the comment board at all.
Okay. I got to tell you the comment. This is from our Australian friend. I love the conflicting points of view between you and John. Makes for a great conversation. So I thought that was a great comment. I really enjoyed that one. Okay, everybody, we'll see you August 10th. Thank you. Be safe. Stay safe. Have a great rest of your weekend coming up, and we'll see you later. Talk to you. Bye.
The Point of Care program at Huntsville Hospital is approaching its 20-year anniversary. As we began to grow as a hospital and provide more complex services to our community, the need for point of care testing became very clear in our organization. Many of our departments consider the EPOC device to be crucial to their ability to quickly move their patients from entry to the hospital to procedural room. It helps them monitor the patient's status during their procedures and post-procedure, so it's very integrated into our entire continuum of patient care. If you have any patient population where blood management is crucial, then a point of care device is very useful in those types of settings. It can provide a quick result on a very small amount of blood, and that is really important in some of our patient population.
We are starting a new process where we're going to screen our patients on the floor for sepsis. The patient can look and actually feel okay. They will show us signs and symptoms of sepsis. So what we do when they show these signs, we get a lactate level.
Lactic acid is a product of the sepsis cascade. So with sepsis, the inflammatory light switch goes on, the cascade starts churning, and unfortunately, once it starts going, we have to stop it. It will not stop on its own. The faster the lab draw, the faster the lab results, the faster you can act on it.
The process in the lab is what the process is. It just takes a certain amount of time for the instruments to run those tests.
I mean, we're talking 30 minutes even on a stat because that's the process. This is how long it takes. There's not really anything you can do about that. For every hour you wait to give an antibiotic, the mortality for that patient increases 8%. So now that we have the handheld device, the nurse can get those results within a few minutes and we know how to treat that patient. If a patient is going into septic shock, we do not have minutes to spare. We have got to get it done quickly. So when you get the little beep from the EPOC that says your results are in, you go with it. You don't even think twice about it. You're like, this is good. This is what I'm gonna do for this patient. The next steps are clear.
I think our mortality on the initial floors dropped by almost 50% in the first 3 to 6 months. At this point, we are about hospital-wide. I think we'll be hospital-wide another 2 to 4 months. So this has become a huge program within our system.
Without the EPOC device, it would really be hard for us to get everything done in the timely manner. So it's really helped us to get our program going.
I mean, whether you're a surgeon, whether you're a medicine doctor, whether you're a dermatologist, you want to be able to do things in a timely fashion so that you can be most effective.
This really makes a difference in patient outcomes.
Mixed cannulae, expanding performance standards. High-performance cannulae for direct and femoral cannulation in minimally invasive cardiac surgery. LivaNova's complete range of mixed dedicated products allow easy and reproducible procedures. The portfolio includes the sutureless aortic valve Perceval, Memo 4D for mitral valve repair, the HeartLink system for assisting the perfusionist in applying goal-directed perfusion therapy, and a broad choice of high-performance dedicated cannulae. LivaNova's range of cannulae suit every cannulation technique for minimally invasive cardiac surgery. Venous and arterial femoral cannulation can be performed using the Wrap Venous Cannula and the EasyFlow Duo. For arterial direct and venous femoral cannulation, the EasyFlow aortic cannula and the wrap are available. For venous femoral access, the LivaNova wrap cannula features a dual stage configuration for optimal drainage of the inferior and superior vena cava without interfering with the right atrium. The high flow dynamics of wrap improves the capability of drainage with a low pressure drop. An optional Sellinger dilator kit is available to perform percutaneous insertion. The LivaNova EasyFlow Duo cannula is designed for a safe and smooth femoral arterial cannulation. Its conical dispersion tip design allows a more gentle flow in the femoral artery, and its red cap avoids blood backflow during obturator removal. A dilator kit for percutaneous insertion is also included with the cannula. EasyFlow cannulae are designed for safe, reproducible, direct aortic cannulation and include a malleable stylet to aid cannulation insertion, facilitating bloodless introduction into the aortic arch, as well as a special conical dispersion tip for a more gentle flow in the vessel to reduce shear stress.
Like all perfusion professionals today, we are busy and frequently short-staffed. Does taking time off for a conference create a burden for your teammates? Has reimbursement for your continuing education dropped? Have you priced the cost of going to a meeting lately? Registration fees, airfare, transportation and parking, hotel, and meals out? This totals up to having an out-of-pocket expense of over $2,500. And then you hope the content is good. Perfusion Education has heard your concerns. They have a simple and seamless system that works on any platform, computer, tablet, or even your phone. You can chat during the program or even phone in and be live on the air. The content, second to none. Perfusion Education is by perfusionists and for perfusionists. Create a free account and check us out today.